Well, good morning and welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. My name is Barbara Park and I'm a member of the congregation. Prairie aspires to be both an open-hearted and an open-minded congregation. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, gender, or family structure. We welcome you no matter what your age, your abilities, or inabilities. On Sunday morning, we provide a wide variety of services presented by either Prairie member of the wider community, as we have today with Olympia Brown, or Sandy Ingham, who is our minister. The opening words today are going to be a responsive reading, which is 569 in your book, Stand by This Faith, from Olympia Brown. And I'll read the regular text and you read the italics stuff. Stand by this faith, work for it, and sacrifice for it.
There is nothing in all the world so important as to be loyal to this faith, which has placed before us the loftiest ideals.
Which has comforted us in our sorrow, strengthened us for noble duty, and made the world beautiful.
Do not demand immediate results, but rejoice that we are worthy to be entrusted with this great message.
That you are strong enough to work for the great true principle without counting the cost.
Go on finding ever new applications of these truths and new enjoyments in their contemplation, always trusting in the one God which ever lives and loves.
Okay, this morning we're going to have the Lou family do the chalice lighting. That's Kate, Catherine, and Aaron.
At this hour, in small towns and big cities, in single rooms and ornate sanctuaries, many of our sister Unitarian Universalist congregations are also lighting a flaming chalice. As we light our chalice today, let us remember that we are part of a great community of faith. May this dancing flame inspire us to fill our lives with the Unitarian Universalist ideals of love, justice, and truth. That's Judith Quarles.
Well, this morning I'm happy to introduce Rose Stevenson as Olympia Brown. Rose is a longtime member of First Society and a member and avid supporter of the League of Women Voters. We have many Unitarian and Universalists in our ranks who have not only been important to our faith, but also important to shaping our country. So let us welcome Olympia Brown.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for coming to hear me speak today. For those of you who don't know me, I am the Reverend Olympia Brown. I was born on January 5th, 1835, in a log cabin outside the town of Schoolcraft, Michigan. I attended Mount Holyoke Female Seminary, Antioch College, and the Theological School at St. Lawrence University, where I was ordained in 1863. I was the first woman in our country to be ordained as a minister and to be recognized as such by a denomination. I also fought long and hard for women's suffrage. I worked hand in hand with Susan B. Anthony, pictured here, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and the many, many other individuals who made women's right to vote a reality. I helped establish the Wisconsin Woman Suffrage Association and I served as its president for 28 years. Now, you may be a little curious about my background. My parents, LaFaya and Asa Brown, married in 1834, and shortly thereafter moved from the Green Mountains of Vermont to the frontier of Michigan, which was then still a territory. The trip was 800 miles in a covered wagon to reach the area near Kalamazoo. Andrew Jackson was president then. My father bought a farm north of the town of Schoolcraft with a tiny one-room cabin on it in which I was born. As a child, I helped my mother with the household tasks, pumping all the water by hand and carrying it to the cabin in buckets, doing the laundry by hand, and I learned how to milk cows, make butter and cheese, spin flax and wool, make candles and soap, bake bread, and salt down meat for the winter. I was the firstborn of four children, and I helped take care of the smaller ones. I learned, even as a child, that there is satisfaction in hard work and accomplishment. That lesson has stayed with me all of my life. Now, unlike many people of that time, my mother believed fervently in equality of the sexes, and she instilled that principle in me and in my sisters and brother when we were still very small. Before a school was established in the area, she taught us how to read, write, spell, and do arithmetic. She read poetry to us and taught us some of the basic universalist beliefs that salvation is extended to all human beings, that God is kind and loving, not angry and vengeful, that there is no such place as hell. My parents, especially my mother, felt that education was essential. And so my father built a schoolhouse on part of his land. When I was 14 years old, my sister and I had outgrown that local school, and we convinced father to allow us to attend the Cedar Park Seminary in town. Although it was quite some distance, we walked it every day when the weather was good, and in the winter we stayed with relatives in town during the week. I went back to teach for one term in the little schoolhouse on my father's farm when I was 15 years old. That experience helped me decide that although teaching is a noble and worthy profession, I wanted to do something else with my life. I began to make plans for furthering my education, but I was frustrated that no university or college to which I applied would admit a woman as a student. Now, my mother read about a school near Mount Holyoke, South Hadley, Massachusetts, that admitted only women. Mount Holyoke Female Seminary, founded in 1836 by Mary Lyon, had gained a reputation as a center of learning, and this is where my mother decided that my sister Oella and I should go. The difficulty was that this would take a good deal of money, and my mother had no money of her own. In those days, when a woman married, all of her possessions became her husband's property by law. My father did not value education as highly as my mother did, especially for women, although he was merely reflecting the general attitude of society at the time. There were no professional careers that a woman could enter into, such as medicine, law, or commerce. It was just accepted that only men needed higher education. Marriage was the role for women, and teaching was almost the only career open to us. Well, with the education that we had then, all my sister and I could ever hope to do would be to teach in a country school somewhere. And I had already decided against that. I took it upon myself to convince my father that my sister and I should attend Mount Holyoke, After all, neither one of us had plans to marry soon. I found the rules and regulations at Mount Holyoke stifling, though. As a diversion, we organized a literary society where we could debate, give readings, and practice public speaking. But at the end of the term, we were ordered to disband it, or we would not be allowed to continue to attend the seminary. It was not considered proper for a woman to speak publicly, and we should not be practicing to do it. We were also forbidden from looking out of the windows for fear that women should appear idle and lazy. At the end of the year, Oella and I returned to Michigan deeply disappointed and frustrated. I couldn't bear to return to Mount Holyoke, but I was determined to get the education needed to shape my future life and work. My father, seeing my determination, surprised me by agreeing to send me to any school of my choice. If I could find one that would admit me as a student, I could go there. Well, I wrote to college after college after college asking for admission, and I was finally admitted by six, or accepted by six. I narrowed the choices down to Oberlin and Antioch, both coeducational and both in Ohio. Now, Lucy Stone and Antoinette Brown had graduated from Oberlin, and I'll show you their pictures. They're right here. Antoinette Brown and Lucy Stone, oh, right there, had both been accepted by Oberlin and had gone there. Excuse me. But neither one of them had been allowed to take part in any speaking exercises as students or to read their essays at the graduation ceremony, as all the men did, simply because they were women. For that reason, I decided against Oberlin and I wrote to Antioch for admission. The curriculum impressed me, as did the Unitarian president and famous educator, Horace Mann. In spite of a liberal spirit there, I still encountered discrimination, sometimes subtle, sometimes overt. For example, lecturers were regularly invited to attend the campus. I heard speakers such as Horace Greeley, Wendell Phillips, Edward Everett Hale, Ralph Waldo Emerson, and others. I began to wonder why women were not invited to speak. And so I asked the chairman of the organizing committee. I was told, there are no women comparable to the men that we have selected. But there are, I said. There's Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Lucy Stone, Antoinette Brown, and Lucretia Mott. They're all well-educated and well-known. Some have spoken at Oberlin College. The committee members were resolute. We can't accept a female speaker who would come to hear a woman lecture. Well, I decided that if I wanted to hear a woman speak, I would have to find one and bring her to the campus myself. The other women students eagerly agreed to help, and together we raised the money. The speaker we selected was Antoinette Brown, a heroine of mine, and I wrote her the invitation myself. She had completed the theology course at Oberlin College, but the officials had refused to ordain her at graduation. Antoinette Brown's visit was a tremendous success, and I was deeply moved by that experience. Women could speak as well as men. I graduated from Antioch in 1860. During my years of study there, I had given much thought to what I wanted to do with my life. I decided to become a minister. I finally convinced my father for support, and I began looking for theology schools so that I could request admission. the theology schools were generous in their rejections. I got used to reading, "We do not believe that ladies are called to the ministry." In March, I received a letter from St. Lawrence, the Universalist Theological School in Canton, New York. Expecting yet another rejection, I was apprehensive as I opened the envelope and I read the words of the president, Ebenezer Fisher. "You will be admitted into the school and have all the opportunities that the school affords." In later letters, he warned me of the problems that I would encounter at an all-male theological school, pointing out that there never before had ever been any female students there. "It is unlikely," he wrote, "that there will ever be any others." "I do not think that women are called to the ministry, but I leave that between you and the great head of the church." That is exactly where I thought it should be left. The Civil War had begun in April of 1861. I arrived at St. Lawrence in the fall of 1861. Although some of the male students were friendly, two of them were anything but. They taunted me openly. "Who would ever go hear a woman preach? What kind of church would hire a woman preacher?" And at night, they would get below my window and mimic my voice, which was soft and high-pitched. This was painful for me, since I had no idea of how to improve it. And a good preacher had to be heard at the back of the church. Over the Christmas holidays, a church nearby agreed to hire me to preach. The congregation liked my sermons and asked me to stay on two more weeks. Good reports followed me back to Canton, and the second term went much better. My second year at St. Lawrence was pleasant and passed quickly, and early in 1863, I began to take steps towards ordination. I knew it would cause strong opposition among the faculty, including Dr. Fisher. So I decided to go before the Northern Universalist Association meeting to plead my case before the ordaining council. I asked only that the board members be fair and impartial, and judge me on my merits and not on my sex. The council members knew that they would be setting a precedent, but my arguments were convincing, and I was ordained on June 25th, 1863. Dr. Fisher took part in the ceremony. My first parish was in Vermont, but the congregation was aloof and unresponsive and seemed to be having a hard time adjusting to a woman minister. When my brother Arthur became ill, I resigned my pastorate in order to go and help my mother care for him. While I was in Ann Arbor, Michigan, I often attended lectures at the university, and one that I attended had quite an impact on me. Dr. Dial Lewis of Boston believed in physical education for women, views which were new and quite radical. And after that lecture, I went up and I asked him if there was a way to improve my voice. "Of course, we have exercises that would develop your chest and lungs. We can teach you how to breathe so that you can lower your voice and learn to protect it." Well, I went to Boston as soon as Arthur was well. I explored the city, attended lectures, and improved my voice. "The voice can be improved as well as any other part of the body," I said. "All it takes is instruction and practice." I practiced every day and developed a voice that gained me national renown as an orator. While in Boston, I visited with the head of the Universalist Association there to find a church that needed a minister. He was uncooperative at first, but I persisted And eventually, he told me of a church in Weymouth Landing, a little town south of Boston. After I preached a sermon there, the congregation voted overwhelmingly to hire me and offered a salary of $500 a year. At last, I had my own church. The installation was July 8, 1864. Newspapers across the country carried the story of my installation, since there were still no other ordained women ministers in the United States. I stayed at Weymouth Landing 5 years. It was a happy time. Now, during the years of the Civil War, women had put aside equal rights activities and we put our energies into war work instead. We had hoped to be given the ballot when peace came, but Congress continued to ignore our demands and a new women's movement began. I attended several women's rights conventions and I found myself drawn in to the cause. Susan B. Anthony had asked me to accompany a small group of reformers on a 6-week campaign tour for equal rights in New York State. We were still touring New York State when a letter arrived asking for a speaker from the East to help Kansas workers gain support for a suffrage amendment going before voters there in the fall. I had no idea at the time that I would be that speaker. I traveled by train to Leavenworth, Kansas, and arrived on July 1, 1876. They had expected a speaker of greater renown, but everyone else had had commitments. I was what they got, and I began to make a name for myself. I traveled from town to town and spoke 7 days a week. I never missed a meeting. I had been promised a traveling companion and a conveyance to get to all these meetings, but when I arrived, I discovered that the money for these things was lacking. I was on my own, and I had to find a way to get from one town to the next. Often this was in an open wagon with no springs. I stayed with whatever family would put me up, often on the floor of a sod house with a blanket over me. To give you a picture of what this was like, this is what Joel Moody, editor of the Border Sentinel of Mound City and a co-campaigner, wrote about me in his newspaper. With her talent and education, she has great physical power of endurance. Lately, speaking 2 or 3 times each day in the hottest weather, traveling from 20 to 50 miles each day with only an average of about 4 hours of sleep, and her speeches from 1 to 2 hours in length, without apparently the least fatigue, and weighing only 91 pounds. Eloquent, hopeful, and brave, with religion as the basis of all her actions and piety her leading trait, she is the best pleader for women that we have yet seen before the public. I had hoped that this campaign would be the beginning of women acquiring the vote. I was terribly disappointed. I learned that the Republican Party had been openly opposing the ballot for women. What's more, liquor interests fought the issue with newspaper advertisements, posters, and speakers. They warned that women wanted prohibition. If we got the vote, we'd close the saloons. Women's suffrage was defeated 19,857 to 9,070, more than 2-1. I was crushed. I returned to Weymouth Landing to my congregation, happy to be preaching and doing parish work again. 2 months after the Kansas campaign, I received several letters from Susan B. Anthony imploring me to give up the ministry and serve the woman suffrage movement as a lecturer. She offered me $1,000 per year above expenses to work for woman suffrage. $1,000. I was making only $800 as a minister. Yet the ministry gave me an opportunity for self-development and fulfillment, and I turned her down. I would continue working for women's suffrage as time permitted. Still, I went before the Board of Trustees of my church with that letter in my hand and my salary was increased to $1,000 a year. The 14th Amendment to the Constitution was ratified on July 23rd, 1868. It gave the ballot to the Negro male, but specifically excluded women. I'd been at Weymouth Landing 5 years. I was beginning to feel restless. It was 1869. I heard of an opening at a Bridgeport, Connecticut church and was accepted as their minister at $1,500 a year. It was painful for me to leave Weymouth Landing. I had many close friends there, including John Henry Willis, who had served on the board of trustees and was the church secretary. In the fall of 1872, Susan B. Anthony decided that she was going to vote. On election day, she and a number of women walked to the polling place and cast their ballots. They were accepted. On Thanksgiving Day, however, Susan B. Anthony and her friends were arrested. It made national headlines. I read the story in the newspaper and I wrote her immediately, applauding her brave act. It was my hope that when Miss Anthony went on trial, the courts would find in her favor, and in so doing, women all across the country would have the right to vote. We all anxiously awaited the progress of the trial. The judge, however, ruled that Miss Anthony was guilty of voting without having the lawful right to do so and fined her $100. Miss Anthony refused to pay the fine. On the home front, I was having trouble in my church. There was a faction of members who had openly opposed having a woman minister, and this caused discord and enmity. I had an offer from a Pittsburgh church at a higher salary, and yet I chose to stay in Bridgeport. I had my reasons. John Henry Willis had moved from the Weymouth Landing Church to Bridgeport a year after I moved there and had become an active member of my new church. Although I was busy circulating petitions, attending meetings, campaigning, attending to my ministerial duties, he was patient and paid me visits when time allowed. He was committed to equal rights and suffrage, and I gradually saw that he was also committed to me. We married in April of 1873. I was 38 years old. My husband was a source of joy to me. As I later wrote, I could not have married a better man. He shared in all my undertakings and always stood for the right. Even so, I kept my own name after marriage, and I've been known as the Reverend Olympia Brown the rest of my life. I was 39 when our son Henry Parker Willis was born. My mother came from Michigan to help take care of the house and baby. She lived with us the rest of her life, which allowed me to spend more time on ministerial and suffrage work. In March of 1876, the dissent in my church reached a head. I lost my pastorate, and the board of trustees, faithful to me, resigned in protest. I now had more time to put into suffrage work. In November of 1876, I had a second child, Gwendolyn Brown Willis, and devoted myself to my family for the following year. In 1878, though I was ready to serve a church again, and I was excited when I read that a Universalist church in Racine, Wisconsin, was without a minister, I wrote to that church at once. The reply I received from Mr. Fish, clerk of the church, did not contain an invitation, however. The Racine Church is in a rundown and unfortunate condition, he wrote. It is adrift, in debt, hopeless, and doubtful where any pastor can arouse them. I am sent to just such churches, I wrote. Let me come and see what I can do. So with that, I was invited. In spite of a terrible rain the entire time I was there, I managed to visit every family in the church. And on Sunday, the pews were filled. The Church of the Good Shepherd voted to call me as its minister. Mr. Willis brought a beautiful house overlooking Lake Michigan and invested it in a newspaper, the Racine Times Call. I organized a Sunday school, young people's group, ladies' afternoon social club, and evening social meetings. The public was invited to the evening lectures and musical programs, and the church grew and prospered. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Susan B. Anthony, Julia Ward Howe, Phoebe Hannaford, and many other friends from the East came to my church to lecture. In 1882, I got involved with the Wisconsin Woman Suffrage Association and later became its president. I organized committees and held suffrage meetings around the state and annual conventions. Members of the association went before the state legislature and urged it to pass a woman suffrage amendment. In 1885, a limited woman suffrage bill allowing women to vote on school matters did pass the state legislature and was ratified in 1886 in Wisconsin. There was a great effort to encourage women to vote in the next election. I asked Susan B. Anthony to come and help organize a statewide canvass. She came, but she let me know that Wisconsin women needed a strong leader, one who could travel, campaign, and organize. She thought that I should be the one to take on that job. I was 52 years old. I'd been in my church 9 years. It was time to start a new career. I resigned my ministry at the Church of the Good Shepherd against the wishes of the board and the congregation, but I promised them I would always stay with the church. And then I began a campaign tour across Wisconsin in the worst months, January, February, and March. And in April, I returned home to vote. Several co-workers and I went to the polls together. But the inspector did not allow us to vote. He maintained that we could only vote for school officials, and then we must use separate ballots and separate ballot boxes, and these were not furnished. We were forced to return home. I wrote to Susan B. Anthony for advice, and partly because of her own bad experience in the courts, she advised strongly against a lawsuit. But bowing to pressure from the executive committee, I did file suit against the inspectors. Although the initial ruling was in our favor, when it was appealed to the Wisconsin State Supreme Court, Brown versus the state of Wisconsin, the decision was that women could vote on school matters only, and the legislature did not provide separate ballots and separate ballot boxes for that for another 15 years. Between 1887 and 1893, I traveled and lectured more than at any other time in my life. I canvassed Ohio, Illinois, New York, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and South Dakota. I went to conventions and lectured in Boston and Washington, D.C. In January 5th, 1893, it was my 58th birthday. And I was truly surprised by a large party to celebrate. It was a delightful event. And yet within 2 short months, my mother died, and then my husband, John, suffered a stroke and shortly thereafter died. I was overcome by grief. I had to learn how to manage his publishing and printing business on my own, and this took much of my time. During this time, I also preached in Maquanago, Nina, and Columbus. In 1909, towards the end of Theodore Roosevelt's presidency, I sensed a new interest in woman suffrage. In England, Emmeline Pankhurst, a name you might know, was staging militant activities with the suffragettes, as they were called there. I prefer the name suffragist for both men and women. In England, they conducted protest marches, sit-ins, and hunger strikes. Now, these tactics were not looked upon favorably by the younger members of the National American or the Wisconsin Woman Suffrage Association. But the old guard was slowly fading away. Elizabeth Cady Stanton died in 1902, Susan B. Anthony in 1906. I had continued my work for women's suffrage, but there was growing dissent among the leadership of the Wisconsin Woman Suffrage Association. I ended up resigning as president, commenting, "I am 77 years old, too old to waste time on political infighting." In 1913, I joined a new party with Alice Paul and Lucy Burns. They're pictured in these pictures here. Take a look later on. Alice Paul and Lucy Burns called the Congressional Union, later on known as the Woman's Party. Our sole purpose would be to get the Susan B. Anthony Amendment through Congress. It stated simply, "The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex." I spoke again before the Congressional Committee hearings on women suffrage. We finally got the amendment presented before Congress. The bill had lain dormant in committee for 27 years. The first vote on women suffrage in the House of Representatives was 174 in favor, 204 against. After President Wilson's reelection, we organized a protest march in Washington, D.C. We began picketing on January 10th in bitter weather. Hundreds of women marched day in, day out. I had just celebrated my 82nd birthday, and I marched with everyone. Finally, Wilson decided that this was an embarrassment not to be tolerated any longer, and he had us arrested and put in jail. Some suffered abuse in jail, and many staged hunger strikes and were force-fed. Newspapers picked up the story, and women across the country were horrified. A furor arose. The Women's Party organized massive demonstrations with thousands of women participating. And then on November 11th, 1918, World War I came to an end. Later on, large contingents of women began attending Congress every time the Anthony Amendment was on the agenda. Finally, Wilson came to his senses, and in 1919, the bill was passed 304-89. 2 weeks later, the Senate passed the amendment 56-25. I reminded everyone that it still had to be ratified. And it wasn't until August 26, 1920, that Tennessee, the 36th and final state, ratified the 19th Amendment and it became law. Wisconsin had been the first state to ratify it. In February, the National American Woman Suffrage Association held a final convention in Chicago. After that convention, they changed their name to the League of Women Voters. In spite of past disagreements, I was their guest of honor at that convention, and I was asked to give a speech. Newspapers reported, "Her excellent voice was not equaled by any of the younger women." I was 85. On November 2nd, 1920, women across America went to the polls and cast their first vote. 72 years after that first women's rights convention in Seneca Falls, New York. So many women and men had worked so long and hard to see this dream come true. And I'm proud that Antoinette Brown Blackwell, the woman who had inspired me to become a minister, and I, the Reverend Olympia Brown, both lived to cast our ballots. Cynthia Brown. Her son became a politician. They both got graduate degrees and advanced degrees. And for a while, her son edited the newspapers, the Washington Post, I believe. And she went there to live with him for a while. And later on, he became a politician and was active in politics in Colorado and so forth. And her daughter, Gwendolyn, became a college instructor and a professor, and was also active as well. They were very, very successful. And she had been criticized throughout her life as being a poor mother and not taking care of her children. But they seem to have turned, which was not true, of course. Her husband helped raising them and her mother as well. And she was a devoted mother. But that was often a charge thrown against her. Well, the right to vote is so interesting. So in the eastern states that were founded early, it was hard for women to get property rights and so forth and so on. There was a battle there. But remember, as the pioneer women went across the United States, they were so active with that pioneer movement. And most of the Western territories were founded with the right to vote for women. So Wyoming, for example, in Wyoming, women had the right to vote there before it was as a territory, even before it became a state, and Colorado as well, and other states. So there were many states where women could vote in presidential elections before 1920. Mm-hmm. So in some states, there was open acceptance of that, but in other states, it was a battle. The old argument that was that women could influence their husbands, so they already had influence on the vote and so forth, but that was the old argument. But I have talked to way back when, I've been doing this for a little while, and I remember in the early days I gave a presentation at the Historical Society in Lodi, and there was a woman who was over 100 there, and she said that she had voted in the first election. Wow. And she was in Nebraska at the time, and she was a teacher, and her principal had made sure that all the women teachers could vote and would help them get to the polls or whatever. So many, many men were promoting this. There was resistance. I mean, there isn't it a crime that they're still, to suppress the vote. Yes, yeah.
Well, thank you so much. Well, Rose is going to read our closing words.
And let me comment that Olympia Brown loved hymns and loved to sing. This is the great lesson. It's from The Opening Doors, a sermon that Olympia Brown gave in Racine, in 1926. And I should say she lived on and was one of the founding members of the American Civil Liberties Union. We can never make the world safe by fighting. Every nation must learn that the people of all nations are children of God and must share the wealth of the world. You may say that this is impracticable, far away, can never be accomplished. But it is the work we are appointed to do. Sometime, somehow, somewhere, we must ever teach this great lesson.
Well, it's been a real privilege and pleasure to have Rose and Trevor Stevenson with us today. And now it's time to greet your neighbors and join us for coffee.